Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The United States is one of the most dangerous places in the industrialized world to have a baby, based on statistics. The U.S. is one of only two countries where the rate of pregnant women or new mothers have died, where they have died has increased. The maternal mortality of black women is especially alarming. African-American women die at three times the rate of white women during pregnancy or right after giving birth. Why and what can be done to stop what are mostly preventable deaths? Joining us on today's program is Dr. Rebecca Sieber. She is an OBGYN with Lancaster Physicians for Women at Lancaster General Hospital. Dr. Sieber, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Also joining us, Dr. Jason Baxter, an associate professor, OBGYN, and maternal fetal medicine specialist at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, and a member of the Pennsylvania Maternal Mortality Review Committee appointed by Governor Tom Wolf. Dr. Baxter, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Scott.
And Dolores Smith is Mission Director, Maternal and Child Health with the March of Dimes in Pennsylvania, Delaware, and South Jersey. Ms. Smith, glad to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here. And thank you for raising awareness of this really critically important issue.
Well, I think as we have this discussion throughout the next hour, a lot of people are going to be surprised at what they hear. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk. WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Any of the three, I'm going to ask all three of you to answer this question, but Dr. Jason Baxter, as a member of that Maternal Mortality Review Committee that, as I mentioned, was appointed by Governor Wolf, the big question is, why is this happening?
Thank you so much, Scott. Yes, I want to say that I appreciate, I'll echo Dolores' comments, that I appreciate the attention that you, Scott, and other members of the media are bringing to the problem of maternal mortality and recognizing the fact that these maternal deaths are really the tip of the iceberg, that there's also a lot of maternal morbidity. For every woman that dies related to childbirth or pregnancy, there's probably about 100 women who suffer morbidity, suffer consequences of the delivery or of the pregnancy. Mm. I think there's a lot more attention being put to it, so we're becoming more aware of it, but this is not something new. This is a trend that's been rising over the last couple of decades.
Dr. Sieber, what do you think?
I think the reasons for the increase in maternal mortality and, as Dr. Baxter mentioned, what we call severe maternal morbidity, or sort of the women who nearly die as a result of pregnancy or childbirth, it's complex. So one of the things that we're seeing is the aging of the population of mothers who are giving birth in this country. Women over 40 are much more likely to experience severe morbidity or mortality. We are seeing an unprecedented increase in chronic disease, obesity, hypertension, diabetes. And then we are seeing also a large increase in women who are suffering consequences of cardiovascular conditions as well. But it is a complex issue. It's not just one thing.
Well, you know, some of the things that you just described there, and we're going to get a little more into specifics of the causes of death in just a moment, but I just want to follow up that a lot of the things you just described sounds as if generally Americans' health is suffering, and that's one of the reasons leading to maternal mortality.
I would absolutely agree with that. If you look over the last two decades, obesity rates, for example, have gone up astronomically in the United States. And we see these trends in other countries as well, but they're falling behind, not quite as quickly as the United States has increased their obesity rates. And with obesity comes other risk factors for chronic disease as well.
And again, we'll talk about some specifics in just a moment. Dolores Smith with the March of Dimes. I understand you are very passionate about this issue. In fact, you had a statistic that I think really would shock many people listening today, that the United States is 49th in the world when it comes to maternal mortality. We are one of only two countries, Serbia being the other, where maternal mortality, mothers dying, the rates have increased. I mean, that in this day and age, that has to shock many people.
And you're so right, Scott. And a really horrifying part of that is that we're talking, for the most part, in developed countries. And while our rates continue to rise, many developed countries, their rates of maternal mortality and severe maternal morbidity actually have declined. And so there's a couple of things involved. One, I think that huge shout out to Dr. Rachel Levine, our Secretary of Health, who formed in October the Maternal Mortality Review Committee. Pennsylvania was one of many states that did not have this. And what we need is to really understand the data, and particularly Pennsylvania-specific data, because that's where we're working. And, you know, March of Dimes and others helped develop what's called a perinatal quality collaborative in Pennsylvania, and the Jewish Healthcare Foundation has stepped forward to help us build that structure, and the Hillman Foundation has sort of, you know, helped step forward, like, to fund this. But the really critical thing is, before we can fix this, we really need to understand the data. And so the work that Dr. Baxter is doing on both those committees, I think, is critically important. One, we need to look at the data, understand it, and then develop some specific ways to address that.
So, Dr. Baxter, it obviously is still being studied, but what does the data say so far, or at least from the eye test, what does the data say to you?
Thank you, Scott. I will say that this is, as I said before, it's not a new issue. I'm glad that it's becoming, getting more media attention and people are becoming more aware of it. The first maternal mortality review boards actually in this country were started last century, actually, in the city of Philadelphia. Philadelphia has had one of the longest-running maternal mortality review boards. I give credit to people like Roy Hoffman and Susan Tu and Asta Mehta, who have published some of the Philadelphia statistics. I'll echo what Dolores Smith said, that under Dr. Rachel Levine's guidance, signed by Governor Wolf, our state of Pennsylvania now finally has a maternal mortality review board. We were, and probably by the end of next year, every state will have a maternal mortality review committee. This last U.S. Congress actually passed a Preventing Maternal Deaths Act to help ensure that all states have ways to look at the data, ways to compare the data, ultimately ways to be able to fix things. People say if you don't, you can't manage what you don't measure. Having maternal mortality review committees are one way to measure this and to start to put together the complex causes and hopefully to turn the tide so that we can start lowering the rate of maternal mortalities. I will say that in this country, California was one of the first states to have a robust system, not only to measure maternal mortality, but also to improve perinatal quality. And they are one of the few states in this country where their rates of morbidity and mortality has gone down over the last couple decades.
So we've established that it is getting more attention and that there are a number of committees and a task force that are studying. But I want to get back to the data. What is the data telling us as far as why this is occurring?
Yes, yeah, so I'll mention, as Dr. Siebert said, there are a number of different causes. Probably the biggest causes that we think about are hemorrhage. So women the world over bleed related to delivery. And the opposite end of that extreme, women are more likely to have blood clots around the time of birth. So those are two of the big causes of death and risk. High blood pressure is another one of them, whether it be preeclampsia or specifically pregnancy related, or severe hypertension. So a lot of the things that we're doing besides just counting is putting processes in place, both at hospitals and in birthing facilities. We want to have bundles of care, what we call safety bundles, so that when something goes different than ordinary, we have systems in place to help remedy them and help prevent morbidity to that mom and that baby.
Dr. Sieber, you touched on a number of causes. As I was looking down through the statistics, I see that cardiovascular disease is the number one killer, whether a woman is pregnant, she dies during pregnancy, or the majority of women, it's pretty close statistically, but the majority of women die within 6 weeks of giving birth to a child. Cardiovascular disease, and we'll kind of run down these things one at a time, but why cardiovascular disease? Again, this kind of goes back to what you had said earlier about general health of Americans.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One thing I do want to point out is that if we're looking at the timing of maternal deaths, so about a third of what we consider a maternal death or a pregnancy-related death happens the day of delivery or the week following. And so two-thirds of these pregnancy-related deaths come outside of those that sort of week surrounding childbirth, which I think might be surprising to a lot of people. So we're seeing more people die during the pregnancy, and we're seeing people die between, you know, 1 week postpartum and 1 year postpartum. So getting back to the cardiovascular conditions, that also is multifactorial. Obviously, you'll have sort of a more unhealthy and an older population giving birth. We're also seeing now women becoming pregnant who were born with congenital heart disease, who in the past were not surviving to childbearing age. And we are now seeing more and more of these women with corrected congenital heart disease becoming pregnant. In addition, and this would be definitely true in Lancaster County, where we have a really large refugee population, we are seeing more women in this country who suffer heart cardiac conditions due to things like rheumatic heart disease, which we don't really see much in this country, but we do see worldwide, and we're seeing more of that in our local area as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Baxter mentioned hemorrhage, and I think that he was right when he said that most people think of hemorrhage as the number one. Actually, it's like fourth on the list. Probably historically, that's what many women died in childbirth from, was hemorrhage. But there are other factors as well, hypertension, and as he mentioned. But hemorrhage, is that still an issue with women? And does that come mostly during childbirth as opposed to afterwards?
So it's absolutely still an issue, and that is definitely one of the things. One of the preventable maternal deaths that is sort of, it's more concrete, it's easier for us to make change with something like hemorrhage. As Dr. Baxter mentioned, there are what we call bundles. And again, California sort of led the way for this. At our hospital, we have protocols for how to handle hemorrhage at the time of delivery, or what we call a postpartum hemorrhage, which can occur, you know, following delivery immediately or up to, you know, days or weeks afterward. And we have really worked to standardize how we handle this. This is one of those causes of maternal death that I think is one of the more easy ones to affect by just standardization and appropriate care.
I ask basic questions sometimes just so people know and have context. What causes a woman to hemorrhage during childbirth?
So if you can imagine, the uterus right before the baby is born is bigger than the baby. It is an extremely vascular organ. In other words, it is very, very well fed during pregnancy by blood vessels. And immediately after the baby is born, the uterus should shrink down to a much smaller size. And by shrinking down to a smaller size, what it does is it compresses the blood vessels that are within it. Sometimes, for a variety of reasons, the uterus, it does not do what it should. It doesn't squeeze like it should. And from that, you get a resulting hemorrhage.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. On this morning's program, we're talking about maternal mortality in the United States, where mortality rates have increased, one of only two industrialized countries in the world where they've increased over the last 20 years. Why? What's happening? What's being done about it? Joining us today is Dolores Smith, Mission Director, Maternal and Child Health with the March of Dimes in Pennsylvania, Delaware, and South Jersey. Dr. Jason Baxter, an Associate Professor of OBGYN and Maternal Fetal Medicine Specialist at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital and member of the Pennsylvania Maternal Mortality Review Committee, and Dr. Rebecca Sieber, who is an OBGYN at Lancaster Physicians for Women, Lancaster General Health. If you have a question or a comment, I see we have some phone calls coming in. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You could go on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And I'm going to go to the phone in just a moment and take some emails as well. But Dolores Smith, a question that just kind of follow our line of conversation before the break. And I'm sure there are a lot of people who are wondering why other countries are being more successful than the United States. What's happening around the world that we've seen a decrease in maternal mortality as opposed to the United States where it's increasing? What are they doing differently?
You know, it's a wonderful question, and I wish it were an easy answer. I think one of the important things to think about is the development of a maternal mortality review committee in this nation and certainly in every state, and then looking at the data from there and introducing protocols, as Dr. Sieber mentioned, these standardized systems of how it is that we care for women during pregnancy and following. But then the third thing that I think we could look at, certainly Notre Dame supports and other countries are doing this very well, but what are our policies? So, you know, how are we promoting all mothers' health? Do we have affordable health care? And that, you know, with the rollback of the Affordable Care Act, we're deeply concerned that pregnancy should not be a pre-existing condition. ACOG and others are looking at, ACOG is the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, looking at making the postpartum period longer than 6 weeks so that women really come in and get the care that we need. We also, certainly in Pennsylvania but around the country, need to look at rural health settings. So, you know, what we call maternity deserts, and March of Dimes and others are very concerned about that. Are there obstetric care facilities available to women if you live in a rural area and you have to travel a distance? And what happens when there is an emergency? And I think one of the wonderful things about the Pennsylvania Perinatal Quality Collaborative is that they're going to begin to look at how do we engage, how do we educate, how do we support those wonderful clinicians who are working in rural settings who might not have access to the latest in information or technology. How do we make sure that every mom in Pennsylvania and every mom in the nation is well cared for? So just top line, there's some of the issues that we're deeply concerned about.
Dr. Baxter, something that Dolores and Dr. Sieber both mentioned, protocols. When we're talking about people being surprised at learning about this issue here in the U.S., that they also may be surprised that protocols amongst hospitals for prenatal care, for childbirth, that they don't, I don't know if they don't exist or they're not consistent. Why not in this day and age?
That's a good question, Scott. And you're correct that those protocols, I would tell you that they do exist, but there are different protocols at different hospitals, and that's why, as Dolores mentioned, some of the initiatives like a statewide perinatal quality collaborative where we can use agreed-upon safety bundles or ways to best care for women in difficult circumstances, sharing those protocols and, frankly, learning from each other. So I'll say that they do exist. They're Dolores had mentioned the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the AIM initiative, utilizing different kind of agreed-upon protocols and kind of sharing that so that it's both in urban and rural hospitals so that when issues come up, people have easy access to them at the bedside. AIM is the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health Program, and one of the things that each and every state should have, not only a maternal mortality review committee, but also perinatal quality collaboratives, and being part of that Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health that really helps to standardize and share those safety protocols. I would like, Scott, to get back to the idea that Dr. Siebert mentioned and Dolores Smith mentioned, this concept of the postpartum time period or the fourth trimester. I think it's one of the biggest secrets about having a baby, the how difficult the fourth trimester is. As Dr. Siebert mentioned, only about a third of the maternal deaths that occur are within that week of delivery, or that week postpartum. The vast majority are occurring even beyond 6 weeks out. What we found in Philadelphia is that two of the causes of maternal death that we haven't mentioned yet today are from things related to social determinants of health, causes like depression, suicide, drug overdose. We've seen a big change over the last couple of years in the city of Philadelphia. The causes of maternal deaths within a year of delivery are actually the rate of drug overdoses in new moms has skyrocketed more than four times what it was even just 3 years ago.
Mm. Let's take a phone call from Carol in Camp Hill. Carol, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just wanted to ask if you could address whether there's a relationship between poverty and these higher maternal death rates.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. I mean, that would seem to make a lot of sense, but let's talk about that, and then let's also follow up with one of the real big issues, and that is that African-American women are dying at a much higher rate than Caucasian women. Dr. Sieber? What's going on as far as poverty goes, and then we can follow up with that question about African American women.
So we definitely see a correlation, and women who live in poverty have a lower socioeconomic status, lower education, things like that, are at higher risk for maternal mortality and morbidity, severe morbidity as well. And I'm happy to speak also about the very striking racial disparity that we see in the United States. And this is a very longstanding racial disparity. And we also, just of note, we see this with infant mortality as well, that Black infants are far more likely to die than white infants as well. And as you mentioned before, Black women are about three times more likely than white women to die from childbirth-related causes, pregnancy-related death. And I want to note that this is true even controlling for socioeconomic status, for education. So even African-American women who are don't have any of those socioeconomic risk factors are still far more likely to die than white women.
Why? I mean, that you see, a lot of people would probably attribute that to a lack of health care. But when you're talking about the only difference being race as opposed to socioeconomic status, what's going on there?
So it's a very distressing subject. And this is really a result of decades and decades of patterns in the U.S. healthcare system. We see institutionalized racism is a longstanding pattern in our healthcare system, unfortunately. And one of the things that a lot of the research is on now is how something called implicit bias affects how African-American women are treated in our healthcare system. So implicit bias, just a quick definition, it's a bias that we have against a certain race or group of people that we are actually unaware of. That's what makes it implicit. And we all have implicit biases about people. But what we've seen through research specifically about this is that women, African-American women who are in the U.S. healthcare system are essentially less likely to be believed, less likely to feel valued and respected, and feel that their complaints are dismissed. And if you look at individual stories of that African American women have told about their experiences, either with near death or their families talk about after a death, is that the theme is we kept telling someone something was wrong, we kept saying that something's not right, and no one would believe us.
Dolores Smith, this is a real problem. I read an account, I believe it was a National Geographic story, that talked about an African-American woman who had a six-figure salary, was a professional. She had some pain, had some complications. She said the doctor not once, or it wasn't just the doctor, but it was even at the hospital, not once asked her about pain. And this seems to be an exact description of what Dr. Sieber just described.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I can't speak to that exact article, but we see it many times. Sunday's New York Times just yesterday had an article about a physician whose family member was being cared for, an African-American woman, and the doctor stood closer to the doorway than to the patient and didn't touch the patient. And so they felt a little bit disengaged. And I think one of the things we really need to do, and that's the beauty of what you're doing today, is we need to empower women. We need to educate women. Women need to know that what is your history, your health history before you get pregnant. When you come into the doctor's office, you need to say, you know, you've not cared for me before because you're my OBGYN, but I have, you'll see my records, I have high blood pressure, or I have, I am a bit overweight, and my sister had diabetes during her pregnancy. My mother had blood clots. What are the things that are available to me? What should I be doing, and how can we partner? And during the course of, obviously, when you're in distress and you get to the emergency room or you're in this really critical condition and the physicians and nurses are wonderful and they're trying to do all they can, but you should be able to advocate for yourself, and there should be a partner there advocating for you, whether it's your spouse, whether it's a doula. You know, whatever you look at, we really need to empower women to ask those questions on their whole life, but all through their health care, but particularly when they're pregnant. Pregnancy has a huge, you know, impact on this mom's health. It's a burden during her pregnancy, how to care for her and her baby. And so educating yourself, asking those questions. Should I be getting a low-dose aspirin? You know, what are my concerns? What should I be worried about? What are the symptoms, the signs and symptoms of, you know, my health and also, you know, my unborn child? And how can I partner with you to have a better outcome for both of us?
Dr. Siever wants to jump in here, but before she does, I just want to follow up with what you're saying. All right. Because we have had a couple questions here from listeners asking what can we do, you know, during a pregnancy. But what you just described, and I think it makes sense for almost any medical condition, illness, anytime you visit a healthcare professional, ask questions, advocate for yourself. But if the professionals are not asking those questions of you, of are you in pain, have you had any problems, or not believing, then it's a one-way street.
Well, I think there's two things involved. One, like we see this a lot with preterm birth, where you might say to a mom, have you had a prior history of preterm birth? She'll say no, and then when the physician or the nurse midwife or practitioner looks at her chart, she sees that her last baby was born at 36 weeks. So you say, well, wait, you did have a preterm child. You didn't carry to term. Oh, but she was okay. So sometimes we have to educate parents and educate moms and dads. There's a huge role for the men in our lives, but educate people to really understand what their health care condition is, and then make sure that the physician or nurse practitioner has my current records. You know, I'm here with your practice. I've never been in your OB office before, but where was I cared for? And that we share all of that, and then also whatever is happening in your life, we need to really share with the physician so that he or she, what medications am I on? What herbal supplements am I on? What else am I doing to partner with the healthcare community to really have the best care? But you're right, Scott. We also need to look at implicit bias and institutional bias. Not that it's intended, but how does it negatively affect women from stepping forward and saying, this is what I need. Are you hearing me? Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important side.
Dr. Siever?
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly that women, that we should attempt to empower women to be their own advocates. But on the flip side, I also don't think that women should have to advocate that hard for themselves. I feel like there is the onus should be on the provider and the care team as well to address their own biases and to be open to whatever the woman has to say. And so, you know, there's implicit bias training that institutions can get, just like, you know, Starbucks went through an implicit bias training. But really what it does is help everyone. And that's not just the provider. It's the triage nurse. It's the medical assistants, everyone who comes in contact with that patient. Because honestly, when a woman has a complaint, she usually is talking to multiple people before she actually gets to the provider. And so if she's dismissed by the initial person who takes the phone call and who tells her, oh, you have a severe headache, you know, take a Tylenol and go to bed, rather than, well, why don't you come in the office and let's take your blood pressure and see how you're doing. So I think it's important to address it from a systems basis, you know, really taking a good look at ourselves and are we treating each individual woman with the dignity and respect she deserves?
Mm-hmm. Before we go back to the phone, because we do have a few phone calls here, Dr. Baxter, you said you mentioned hypertension. Dr. Sieber just said something about blood pressure. It got my attention because traditionally, and we know that African Americans, Black Americans have more hypertension, more high blood pressure issues than white Americans. Is that a contributor to this?
While there may be some medical conditions that people are more prone to, I don't think that's the major contributor. I have to agree with everything that Dolores and Dr. Sieber said in the sense that it's our implicit bias. Our implicit bias in this country, our implicit bias in the medical system. I wholeheartedly agree with Dr. Siebert's comments that implicit bias training, someone can do a search for implicit bias training or for testing themselves. We all have implicit biases. To follow up on another point, while I wholeheartedly agree that patients that women need to be empowered to be able to speak up for themselves, we as healthcare providers working in a team, our most important tools are really our ability to listen. And I'll often say to my colleagues that to keep in mind that we're given one mouth and two ears, and we should use them in those appropriate proportions.
Let's take a call from Jeremy in Gettysburg. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was a childbirth educator for 20 years, and this statistic that you're addressing today is certainly not new. One thing I'm curious about that I haven't heard your experts bring up is the high rate of medical intervention and medical management of the birth process itself that exists in the United States that is not the case in other industrialized countries, and how those interventions, for example, the high use of Pitocin in order to manage a timely birth instead of following maybe the more leisurely biological process of birth, and how that might engage a mechanism in a woman that could increase her likelihood of hemorrhage or the inability of the uterus to contract properly after the baby is born.
Thank you very much for your call. Dr. Sieber, we actually have a couple of questions along this line of the procedures that we have here in the United States. In fact, let me quote one of our emails that we got a little bit earlier, because they ask, I've heard the U.S. has a higher rate of C-sections and epidurals in other countries. Is this true? If so, does this have any connection to the increased maternal mortality rate? So there's a few questions there about interventions, medically here in the United States.
I think it's important to note that in the United States, depending on which hospital system you're looking at and across the country, rates of intervention, rates of cesarean delivery, and rates of epidurals vary greatly. So you may see some hospitals who have a cesarean for, first-time moms, uncomplicated, low-risk first-time moms, of a cesarean rate of maybe 15%, whereas there might be some other hospitals that have a rate of, say, 60%.
Whoa. Can I just hit that much of a disparity?
Yes. There can be a wide range. That's very complex. The reasons for cesarean delivery, it's never an easy decision for the person who makes it. And the reasons for it vary widely and varies on the health system, the availability of resources, the availability of anesthesia. It's a complex issue, but it does vary quite a bit depending on what area of the country you're talking about.
That would seem to go back to the protocols that we were talking about. Dr. Baxter, understood that Justice Dolores was describing earlier, especially with rural healthcare systems, resources being available, that all those things have to be taken into consideration. But is that part of the protocols that you're talking about?
That may be part of the protocols, but most of the protocols relate to safety bundles or when something goes wrong. Getting back to the caller's comments about increased medical interventions, I'm a high-risk pregnancy physician and have a lot of technology and tools available to provide safe care during childbirth. But I will tell you that the right kind of childbirth, the best birth, is the birth that's right for that particular woman. And so doesn't necessarily need to have any interventions, needs to have things available in case things go wrong or in case someone unexpectedly has high blood pressure, unexpectedly has a hemorrhage. So you want those resources to be available. But fortunately, most births do go well. Most births require minimal intervention. We as healthcare providers and fully empowered women patients need to be able to have access to the to the types of protocols, the type of intervention that's right for them.
Well, let me ask
most people that's very minimal.
Let me follow up with the caller's question, though. If there are more medical interventions happening here in the United States, but yet our maternal mortality rate is increasing. I mean, that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Let's ask the question this way. Does that mean that the maternal mortality rate would go up even more if there weren't these medical interventions? Who wants to take that one?
It's a good question, but I think one of the things that is we're not talking about as much is the risk to babies versus risk to moms. And one of the points of emphasis is that, unfortunately, during pregnancy and soon thereafter, so much of the emphasis is put on the baby at the expense of the mom. A colleague of mine used an analogy of a piece of candy in the candy wrapper, that once the baby is born, the candy is cherished and the wrapper is thrown away. And that's a unfortunate, terrible analogy that I think is too much espoused in this country, that the attention is not put on the mom enough and taking good care of her.
You're listening to Dolores. Can you hold on just 1 second? I got a break here, but I'll come to you as soon as we get back from the break. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about maternal mortality today with our guest, Dr. Rebecca Sieber. She's an OBGYN with Lancaster Physicians for Women at Lancaster General Health. Dr. Jason Baxter, an associate professor, OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine specialist at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia. He's a member of the appointed Pennsylvania Maternal Mortality Review Committee. And Dolores Smith, Mission Director, Maternal and Child Health, March of Dimes in Pennsylvania, Delaware, and South Jersey. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532 on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF, 1-800-729-7532. By the way, before we get back to our discussion, we have a Smart Talk road trip coming up tomorrow, and there's still time for you to get in on it. We'll be at the Hershey Theater tomorrow. It's the 125th anniversary of the start of the Hershey Company. I'm talking a lot about history and some other things having to do with Dairy Township and Hershey. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. If you would like to join in, you can go to WITF and RSVP by going to WITF.org/events. Dolores Smith, I cut you off right there at the very end of the that segment of the program. What's on your mind?
Oh, no problem, Scott. You know, one of the things that we were just talking about is the medical intervention during pregnancy, and these become policy issues. So as Dr. Baxter said, you know, there's the issue of maternal mortality. There's also the issue of infant mortality. And physicians and nurse practitioners, midwives have to make a decision. Does this child need to be delivered now? And if so, then there is medical intervention. March of Dimes has worked for a number of years now on this Healthy Babies Are Worth the Wait campaign, where we said, is that medically indicated? Do we really need to have a C-section? And if not, is it at convenience? Is there some reason that we're delivering me today? And sometimes mom is asking for an early delivery so she can get home in time for some effort or, you know, some family thing, and sometimes the healthcare system needs her to deliver today. But women should be empowered to ask the question, is a C-section necessary? Because once you have a primary C-section, chances are all your deliveries are going to be by C-section. There are physicians who will work with you to avoid that, but it's not an easy thing to do because because you have concerns about this, you know, surgery and this disruption on the woman's abdomen. So, you know, but these become policy issues. And so looking at what our rates of C-section are by hospital is one of the things that a Pennsylvania Perinatal Quality Collaborative would do, and then go in and help the hospital, not to call them out, but really to help educate how can we reduce that rate, but also ensure the safety of mom and the baby. And that's a huge, huge responsibility on these clinicians who attempt to do everything they can well, but women also need to be part of the conversation. Ask the question, be educated about your health and the health of your baby.
Let's take a phone call from Pat in Harrisburg. Pat, thanks for being patient. You're on the air.
Oh, no, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering this. Does abortion have affect the way the mortality rate is hurting women? I have a friend that she got very sick after an abortion, and we could have lost her. And then is that even counted in the mortality rate, the amount of women who died during that procedure? And then does the procedure cause problems down the road for women who get pregnant and want to keep the child this time? And then the womb is messed up from the abortion maybe once or twice or multiple times. That was my question.
Dr. Seaver, what about that?
So the short answer is yes. So those deaths after having an abortion procedure would be counted. So pregnancy-related death is the Center for Disease Control, the CDC's definition of a death of a woman due to a pregnancy-related cause or a condition that's aggravated by pregnancy, regardless of the outcome of the pregnancy. So it could be a preterm delivery, a full-term delivery, a miscarriage, an abortion, or an ectopic pregnancy. And just to kind of look at causes of maternal mortality, deaths as a result of, essentially a death from if it were following an abortion procedure, the most common thing that would happen would be an infection. And those number of deaths, infections specifically related to that procedure, are extremely low. That's not one of the leading causes of death in women in this country. And then to answer the second part, does that affect her future childbearing? And I would say extremely rarely. There is a condition that can happen when a woman has had multiple instrumentations of her uterus. In other words, if her uterus has had an instrument in it, either a suction or even a woman who undergoes something called a DNC, which is not pregnancy related, where the lining of the uterus is sort of with an instrument, is removed with an instrument, it can cause a very, very rare scarring, which could make pregnancy more difficult down the line. But I would say in all my years of practicing, I have actually never seen it. I've just seen it in textbooks. So very rare.
Let's take a call from Meredith in Hershey. Meredith, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I want to first thank Dr. Siebert's group because I think they truly practice some of these practices that they're preaching in terms of allowing a woman to take the time to ask the questions and to learn more about her health. And my question is, though, do you feel that the way that health insurance reimburses for prenatal care and maternal care really aligns with your philosophy that you're speaking of? Because I've found that previous providers that I've gone to have given me only 5 minutes and have walked out while I'm asking questions. And in addition, most insurance doesn't cover any prenatal classes, birthing classes, or lactation classes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your call, Meredith. Dr. Siever?
I think that insurance is a significant issue when it comes to prenatal care in this country. So if you're looking at how insurance reimburses the providers and hospitals for prenatal care, it's done in a way that's called bundling. In other words, there's a one-time fee for all of the prenatal visits, for the delivery, and for the postpartum care. That's all bundled into one fee. And so that makes it difficult for some practices and some providers to be able to spend as much time as they would like to with each individual patient. So we're always sort of working against that. But in addition, the way that insurance, I think, another way that insurance really affects our statistics here would be for the patients who have Medicaid or state medical insurance. And in that case, most pregnant women who have Medicaid will lose, unless their income is very, very low, will lose their insurance approximately 6 weeks after they give birth. And as Dr. Baxter mentioned, we're seeing a lot of deaths from that time between 6 weeks after delivery to 1 year after delivery. And for the majority of Medicaid patients, they will lose their insurance during that period of time. So what we see is women not approaching any healthcare provider with their symptoms at that point because they don't have the insurance to pay for the visit.
Dolores, did I hear you want to jump in?
It wasn't me interrupting, but I do think it's a critically important issue that women need to access their own health care. You know, we have a wonderful project with the family medicine physicians in Pennsylvania, and it's now part of a national effort. But really looking at, they're doing a brief intervention during the well-child pediatric visit. They're doing a maternal check-in. So, you know, a child should be seen 9 times in the first 2 years of life. And as anyone who works in any work setting, we don't take off when we're ill. We save our sick days to take our kids to care. So women are getting pediatric care. So is there an opportunity in the pediatric setting during a well-child visit to say to mom, if you're smoking, can we refer you to a resource to that? Do a two-step depression screen. Can we look at referring you to services? If you want to get pregnant, can we make sure you're taking a multivitamin with folic acid and getting health care before you get pregnant? And if you don't want to get pregnant and you're looking at, you know, an effective pregnancy interval, then can we refer you to those services? And the Family Medicine Education Consortium started this, and actually one of Dr. Siebert's colleagues, Dr. Stephen Radcliffe, who runs at Lancaster General, one of the largest family medicine residency programs in the nation, started this project, but it's moved all over the country. But women also have to make sure they get their care, get your self-care, get regular care, have a relationship with your health care provider, so that your next pregnancy is healthy. And I think that's an important issue.
We have about 3 minutes left and a lot of questions. Kayla asked probably one of the most important ones. You've all touched on this, but she says, I'm planning on starting a family within the next 2 years. What would be the things I should look for from a hospital and an OB to ensure that they're prepared for any emergency that might occur and have best practices for women and babies before, during, and after pregnancy? Who wants to take that one? Dr. Sieber?
I'm happy.
Oh, go ahead, Dr. Baxter. Go ahead.
I'll just echo for Kayla's question some of the things that have been said previously that Kayla needs to feel empowered to be able to speak up and to be able to work with people that she knows will listen to her. To get back to another caller's question about interventions, I think women need to be empowered to ask why and to ask what the risks, benefits, and alternatives are to any intervention that comes up, and then to say, hey, what would you do for your family member?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Sieber, you want to add to that?
I think it's important to just sort of at your first visit with any prenatal provider, kind of ask them an open-ended question. How do you approach prenatal care? How do you approach labor and delivery? You know, how does the hospital handle emergencies? Things like that. Well within your right to ask those questions. And what we're seeing now is that statistics on maternal mortality and severe morbidity are beginning to become public knowledge for different hospitals. So that information is also available on the internet as well.
We only have a minute left. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today and some great questions from our audience as well. Dolores Smith, let you have the last word here. This probably is an eye-opener for many people, the discussion we've had over the last 60 minutes or so. So what has to happen in 60 seconds or less? We've touched on a lot of these things, but what has to happen to improve this situation and improve the health of women and babies?
Well, a couple of major things. Certainly women need to be engaged in their own self-care. I think what Dr. Sieber said is critically important. Go, and kudos to you, Kayla, for really planning your pregnancy. Shop around, find a provider that you feel very comfortable with, and then make sure that you follow up, that you share whatever information about your health, critically important, before you're pregnant, through your pregnancy, and postpartum. And then critically important, make sure you take that postpartum visit. Probably 50% of women fail to come back for their postpartum visit. And that's a very important period where you're still at risk and also then it's that interconception period, planning for your next pregnancies, not only the health of your baby, but the health of mom. And dads have a huge role in getting us to access health care.
Thank all three of you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, a Smart Talk road trip to the Hershey Theater. So be sure to come out and join us. I'm Scott Lamar.